So when I said Velvet, start fucking.
Hello.
Wait. How does that go? At least he got the fuck ups out of the way early.
I see.
Oh, fuck, psych, set on the joke's goal.
From the burning mesas of the Arizona desert to the slot machine-clad boardwalks of New Jersey, it's the Imaginarium with Scott and Todd. I'm Scott Colbert.
And I'm the horror nerd, Todd Staruch.
And I know how much our audience loves when we talk about weather, so I figured I would let everybody know that it's finally been under 100 degrees the last few days.
Nice.
Like 96, 97, but that's still under 100 degrees, and that's enough for me to get out the thermal underwear.
I know, right? Yeah, I mean, it is the best day of the year so far here. It's 70 degrees, sunny, not a cloud in the sky. I mean, it is glorious weather here in New Jersey.
Well, it was about 76 at 7 this morning. That's all low.
That is the amazing thing about the Valley of the Sun. Like, you can wake up and need a jacket.
Yeah.
And then by 10 o'clock, it's like, oh my God, I am in the ninth circle of hell.
Yeah. And this is going to present some clothing issues for me next week. I start training for my new position, the one that I had to get that security clearance for. So they finally put me in a training class for it, but it's 7 to 3 every day. So it'll be chilly in the morning. By the time I get out, I'll be sweating my balls off.
I never thought I would hear the phrase security clearance in the same sentence with your name.
Scary, isn't it?
That is absolutely horrifying.
The fact that the State Department has given me any kind of a clearance should frighten everyone in this country.
Wow. Wow. Oh, my God. So real quick, before we introduce our guest, I can't help but giggle over the whole incident with what's-her-face. I can't pronounce her last. Lauren Bobert.
Oh, being
kicked out of Beetlejuice for giving whoever it was, giving someone a hand job in the audience. That was freaking awesome.
It wasn't. And they owe Al Franken an apology.
Yes, 100%. I mean, come on. Whatever. I just thought it was funny, you know, of all stories that I thought I'd see in the news that day. That was not one of them.
Yeah, that was not my favorite part either.
No.
Because I can't speak for everyone, but the idea of Lauren Boebert and hand job in the same sentence is as frightening as myself and security clearance in the same sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, Scott, I will say, at our respective ages, I'll pretty much take any action I can get. I'll take a hand job from you. Just saying.
I'll hold you to that.
Anyway.
Before our guest runs away from this.
Yeah, he's about to hang up. Yes, we actually have a guest this week. This is a guy that I met a couple of months ago at the horror, Ryan Scott Weber's Horror Sideshow Flea Market. He was vending there. And I have always said this at all of these events, conventions, flea market, whatever. I walk around, I go to a lot of these, as you know, and the best people there are the ones who are friendly and engaging and make you want to find out what they are selling or what they are doing. And this gentleman was one of them. I was just immediately engaged. And we kind of just hit it off. I bought a couple of his books, which will go in the I may never read pile, along with yours, Scott. But just hit it off. Super nice guy. We've met at a couple other shows since then, so I thought it would be cool to have him on the show. He is your brethren, a horror author and publisher, Mr. Damon Manx. Damon, welcome to the Imaginarium.
Hey, Todd, Scott, thanks for having me. And speaking about hand jobs, I mean, no, I, you know, you guys introduced me with that little segue, and yeah, you know, like I had never really been interested in going to see Beetlejuice the musical before. Suddenly, I'm quite enticed by the idea. Although I will say this about Lauren Boebert. I have her down for giving very toothy blowjobs.
Wow. Okay. Good to know. I wonder if that's like an upcharge on the ticket, like when you go to see Beetlejuice. It's like there's like a menu like of add-ons that you can have.
So that's what all those extras are when you buy through Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
Service charge.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Oh my God.
So Damon, I need to tell you one thing about Todd and books. He will buy your books, but he won't read them. However, if you have them on Audible or any kind of audiobook, he'll listen to those. So you get twice the money from him.
That's fantastic. And oddly enough that you bring that up, which segues into my very first shameless promotion.
Bring it on.
Yeah, so check this out. So my very first book that I wrote, which I'll tell you in a little while where that book came about and how it came about, it's called Abigail, which is a very short 50-page book. That was the first one that went out on Audible. And if either of you gentlemen are interested, I have a couple free promo codes for that book. It's very much a Twilight Zone story, or could be a Twilight Zone story. The most recent endeavor in the audio field is due to come out within the month, which is called Arcranium, which is a full theatrical production that we've had a guy named Lee James from Australia did with multiple characters. We've got female and male voices. We have sound effects. We have our own backup music tracks to this. And most of this story takes place inside the world of artificial intelligence versus virtual reality program called Arcranium. And it Lee James did an amazing job with it. And that's coming out in like a month.
Cool.
Oh, that sounds very cool. That's something that I should look into. You know, kind of dramatizing one of my books. You know, Errors of the Flesh would be awesome done that way.
It would be. It would be horrifying. It would be pretty awesome.
It would be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Now, so all kidding aside, I get myself into a bind because I really do love supporting people. I'm an indie filmmaker myself, so I know I feel like we're all in this together. So I love buying stuff, and then I can just never seem to get around to it. So I had never really, I don't know if believed is the right word, but kind of bought into audiobooks. I thought it was cheating. But then when my ex-wife and my daughter moved to Virginia and I had a 6-hour drive each way to go see my daughter, that's what I did, is I started listening to audiobooks to pass the time. And I'm like, well, at least I'm still supporting the authors out there, you know, because I buy the physical copy. And then, like Scott said, I buy the audio copy anyway to listen to. So at least I do get to experience it in my defense.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the mediums change over the years. You know, at one point, nobody had a TV. We were listening to the radio to get our entertainment. Then television came along, or we were going to the movies. Now we're just streaming. You know, it's the progression of literature, you know, and any way you do it. But I mean, at any day of the week, I'd rather just be sitting on your shelf than not sitting on your shelf.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always thought about it as, you know, I've got the money from the sale. What they do with it after that, I don't care. I've already got the money.
Yeah, well, I get that, but I really...
I mean, I would like people to read my story.
Yeah, I do want that emotional connection. I would... That's kind of, you know, I'm about the emotion of the stepping inside the reader's head, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So how would you describe the type of horror that you write? Is it like balls to the wall or quiet horror or this term that I really hate now? And I hate it so much I've forgotten what it's called.
Elevated horror?
No, it's cozy horror.
Oh, geez.
It's what?
Yeah, cozy horror.
Cozy horror?
Yeah, I don't know.
I've never even heard that term.
I've heard that. So I go by the moniker of speculative fiction. And I would say most of my short stories, a lot of my novels could be extracted right and put into a Twilight Zone episode where, you know, I just turn it upside down and you don't know how it ends. I've never had one reader say, oh, I saw that coming. You know, most of the time it's like, you know, I was sure I knew who the murderer was. And then, boy, you pulled the wool out from under me, you know? So I go with speculative. I don't go full out gore unless when it's needed. And I will reserve the right to do that at any point in time. There is atmosphere, but I don't go on for four pages describing the leaves on the ground. You know, I like to mix atmosphere, tension, suspense, description with action. And I like the words to flow quickly, and I like the pages to turn rapidly. So, and you know, when there is that time that the violence is happening, if it calls for descriptive prose, then so be it. So I kind of think I'm walking between all the genres of horror without limiting myself.
Cool.
I appreciate that, because the three novels that I have, they're all very different from each other. Although Todd puts them under one category, the "What the fuck is wrong with you" category.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Although Life in Amber, not quite so much.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was a little more grounded in, well, in reality, I guess. But yeah, the other two, I really think you should be taken into custody.
See, I love compliments like that. I really do. It makes me know that I did my job well.
Awesome. So, Damon, did you know you wanted to be a writer from an early age? Like, what steered you in that creative direction?
Yeah. So, you know, my mother was a journalist. And so that was always there, and she always instilled reading, and she always instilled education as far as that goes. And my first love for a movie was seeing Jaws in the theater at a very young age, at which point I went right home and wrote a sequel to Jaws, which was done more so as a screenplay with me as the main character, and my family were all in the movie. And it was written as best as like a 9-year-old could put together. So yeah, I mean, I always wanted to write. Was I always writing? No. I fell away from it for the high school years and got into being in a band and writing music for a while. Then years down the road, working construction, my life took a very serious turn. I got hurt on the job right around the time I turned 40 and was prescribed painkillers. And I became instantly addicted to painkillers. That led to a prison sentence for me because opiate addicts make really, they're known for making really great choices. So I was one of those who made, you know, really great life choices, found myself in the prison system, lost everything, you know, from my wife to my business to self-respect, everything. And it's actually in the prison system where, you know, I found recovery. I went on to get a college degree, and I decided that I really wanted to become a horror author. And I started putting pen to paper and wrote some of my very first releases while I was in the prison system.
Wow. Wow, that's something, man. Well, first, let me just say good on you, man, for coming through on the other side. A lot of people don't. So cheers to you for getting right and moving on with life. That's awesome.
This Halloween, I'll have 11 years clean and sober.
That's great, man. Cheers.
Thank you.
I'm not sure cheers would be the most appropriate. Well,
man, yeah, probably not. But
Mazel tov.
Mazel tov.
Yeah.
And now, anyway, I have a family member who went through something similar and did a stint in prison and now has been clean for about 18 years. So
fantastic.
He came out on the other side as well. And like I said, a lot don't. So good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that you know, you see things when you're in prison, you witness things and you can take that road. There's two paths you can go down, man. You can go down the dark one or you can follow the light. And I chose the light. And while I was choosing the light, I witnessed a lot of dark. So that influenced a lot of the stories that I've written, which is also Abigail. My first release came out of that experience. So, you know, it actually gave me a lot of food for fodder. You know, it really, I think it shaped, well, it certainly shaped who I am as a person, shaped who I am as a writer, and it definitely shaped the material that I write.
Well, I'm how could it not?
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, I had a lot of conversations with my brother, and if just half of what he told me about prison life was true, I realized, Todd, you can never, ever go to prison. You will not, you will not survive the first night. You just won't.
I considered myself that person that, certainly never intended to go to prison, never thought of myself as somebody who would do well in there. And I got in there and I found that if you're honest, if you say what you mean what you say, if you're going to do something, you stick to it, you're the same person day in, day out, never put up a front, never lie, never try to be somebody else. You know, and if you're wrong, apologize for that. That will go tremendously far in prison. You will be in my case, I walked in there and I was immediately respected for who I was, and the way I conducted myself. I was befriended by some of the leaders of like some very serious gangs in there, and I was even taken under the wing by a former hitman for one of the large Italian families here in New Jersey who, you know, he took me under his wing. He brought me around to different religious functions, different self-help groups, kind of, you know, he had found a different way to live and navigate in the system and was trying to atone for some of the horrible things he did. And by doing so was kind of mentoring other guys. I was fortunate enough to meet this man and become under his wing. So my story kind of is a little unique to what many might have as a prison story. So.
Yeah, that's certainly not the usual prison story that we're used to hearing, or I'm used to hearing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm in recovery myself, and some of the stories I've heard at meetings from people who've been in prison, I mean, it just, it's far scarier than anything I could ever think about writing.
Mm. Yeah, well, it can be, that's for sure. And I've seen a lot of guys get have a nightmare trying to navigate those days and years inside the system.
So, Damon, whenever we have an artist or a musician or, you know, an author on the show, I always like to ask this question because I'm fascinated by it. How does inspiration strike? Do you set aside time each day and say, okay, I'm going to write at this time and whatever comes to me, comes to me? Do you sit bolt upright in the middle of the night with an idea and jot it down to come back to it later? How does inspiration strike for a new story?
You know, at the moment, for the last couple of years, I spend my 9 to 5 in this business. You know, whether it's sitting at the keyboard, I'm at the keyboard pretty much from 9 to 5 every day, sometimes earlier. And that's the time for me to either be writing or working on something that's getting published, or edits or promotion or something. So generally, inspiration comes from a lot of different places. A lot of my inspiration is drawn from experiences or nightmares or a combination of the two. I'll have an idea for a story and maybe start writing it. But there's always this point where, you know, just the single idea on its own is never enough to make a full story. It's a good beginning point. But for me, the way a story always is finalized, or the way it really comes together, is when it becomes a combination of two ideas, where and that will usually come to me in the very, like, the final few minutes before I fall asleep, where this idea will come. Well, what's the twist of the book? What's the next part of the book? What happens here? How do I progress this story? That comes before I, right before I fall asleep. If I'm lucky, I remember it, or it'll get me out of bed and I'll write it down, and the next day I'll work through that. That seems to be the very inspirational part for me. The writing process has changed over the years. It used to be I wrote at night. Now I write during the day. I used to listen to music. Now I have to have silence. You know, it's changing. I kind of consider myself, I don't know. I morph from one writer into the next as the years progress.
All right, there's that awkward silence I was waiting for.
I was waiting for it. I was, oh, did I lose him?
No, not at all. I've been having internet issues on and off all day today. So all of a sudden, like, my network connection will just drop for like a second. But we are known for our long and glorious history of awkward silences.
Nice, nice.
So I sometimes do it on purpose to see if Scott's paying attention when he edits the show. So I just won't say anything for 10 seconds. Like,
and that's usually because I was waiting for you to say something. But before that, we started earlier in the show, Damon, you were talking about the origins of your first novel. So can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So the book is called Abigail, a little 50-page novelette. Got nominated for a Splatterpunk Award, and it got nominated for Best Short Story with the Horror Authors Guild. It didn't win either of them. It's okay. I'm not bitter or sour. I'm over it. But thank you for, you know, acknowledging that. It's still a little tender. The story itself, Abigail, is about a man living in Florida, a gay man who has been bullied growing up. He's been marginalized. And, you know, he's got a very dour and bitter outlook on life. Pretty sure he's never going to find happiness. He comes home after what is probably the best date of his life to find a basket on his front steps. And he cautiously goes up to the basket. He opens the basket, and there's a baby in the basket. And he looks closely at the baby, and the baby has horns and violet eyes and a forked tongue and scales on it. And even though all those differences, he's overcome with this emotion of adoration, and he sees this child as the most beautiful creature he's ever seen and vows to do whatever it takes to protect the child. That was inspired living in the prison system, living with guys who, you know, came from inner cities, marginalized backgrounds, all who had been marginalized by the system and probably marginalized growing up. And I thought, well, you know, you've got all these guys who have all been marginalized. There's probably a camaraderie among everybody, you know, and honor among like-minded individuals. However, their reaction to men in the system who were either gay or trans in any way was very different, and they were unaccepting of those individuals. So I'm like, well, this is the most strange dynamic I've ever seen. Men from marginalized background marginalizing people from even more marginalized backgrounds. I just thought it blew my mind. So I wanted to write a story about that, with kind of highlighting racism, homophobia, bigotry, and try to deliver a message of, hey, we're all the same on the inside kind of thing, you know. And I'm told I did it with Abigail. You know, of course, you'll never know, Todd, because it'll just sit on your shelf. But
wow.
I'm kidding.
Look, I was about to click on order now on The Last Waltz Shop, but you know what? Clear basket.
Yeah, clear basket. Okay. Like I said, I'll give you the audio book. Yeah. Yeah, so that's Abigail, and that was my first one, and that's where that came from.
How long did that take you to write?
You know, I can't even tell you how to be certain, but I wanted to say a month or so to write the 50 pages. And that was like painstakingly going through it, because there's along the way in Abigail, everything means something along the way. None of the words are just thrown in. There's a lot of meaning in there. And names of things are purposefully used. And then so I wrote Abigail, and in prison, you know, I didn't have a word processor. So I hand wrote everything into a composition book. And I got out and I'm looking through it, and I couldn't even read my own handwriting. So I'm transferring it to the computer and I'm editing it. And I'm looking, and like the last three pages are missing. So I couldn't find them anywhere. So I actually had to rewrite the very final scene of Abigail over and really spent a lot of time editing. I had this, this is a funny story. So I had a real master plan of, you know, I'm going to collect all these short stories. I'm going to write these other novelette size and novella size stories. And when I get out, I'm going to put everything in the computer. I'm going to edit everything, get everything polished to the best of my ability, start submitting to magazines. Hopefully I'll acquire those much needed rejection letters, and then maybe get an acceptance down the road, and then start looking for like an indie publishing contract. So I got out and I did all that. And within the first 3 months, I start submitting to magazines, and I did get those rejection letters. Then I got accepted into a magazine. And then like 2 weeks later, I got accepted into another one. I said, well, it's time to start submitting to indie publishers. So I fabricated a query letter in the form of, like, please take care of my little novelette, Abigail. I'm no longer able to provide a good home for her. I know your company will be a good fit for her. Please don't feed her milk. She's very lactose intolerant. And I got an answer back in an hour after sending, saying, you know, that's the most clever query letter I've ever got. I'm reading your story right now. And and they jumped on it. And so I signed with a company. Unfortunately, they were on their way out when I signed with them. And a couple months later, they had to close shop. And I said, well, geez, how hard could it be to open a publishing company? Famous last words. Yeah, so here I am a few years later with Last Waltz Publishing. And let me tell you, it's not that easy, but you know, I enjoy it. I love the authors I work with, and now all my own titles are under my own label. So that's a beautiful thing, and I'm responsible for my success. I'm responsible for my failure. Either way, it's balls in my court.
That sounds a lot like my indie filmmaking world. You know. It's when Amazon or Netflix or whatever is not knocking on your door, you need to, you know, self-distribute and things like that. And like you said, you're responsible for your own success and your own failure. So I definitely can empathize there.
Yeah, that's totally it. And hey, you know, maybe we can talk in the future. So one of the biggest things I've been taking up my time is, towards the end of my incarceration, once we went under COVID lockdown, I had this little Alpha Smart tablet thing that I could write like 10 files in it at a time. And I started what I thought would be a short story based on a creature feature around Halloween time. 520,000 words 6 months later, I realized it clocked in being 10,000 words longer than Stephen King's The Stand. I have since edited it down. I've been working on this now for the last 4.5 years, and it's coming out next year. My life's work to date, 4-book series with a limited edition, 1,000-page hardcover version of it. And we should talk about making a movie there, Todd.
Listen, I'm down. I have been. So look, although, because I know exactly what Scott will say, don't listen to any promises that Todd makes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and Scott knows this. I don't just blow smoke. I did enjoy Scott's work very much. It's right up my alley. And I said, oh, you know, Barbed Wire Kisses, I would love to take that and turn it into a movie. The problem is, at the indie level, you kind of write yourself into a corner that you cannot afford to actually produce, right?
Absolutely.
Because I started thinking about, like, oh, this is going to require a lot of practical effects. This is going to require locations because it's sort of a Western, you know, it's also a ghost story. And I'm like, oh, my God, how would I ever even afford this, you know? But I do enjoy writing when I have the time. So, you know, but a 1,000-word novel, that would be about a 17-hour movie. So let's make the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking we'll shop it as a 4-season series to Netflix, and we'll just make the first trailer, the about 40 minutes of the opening book. And then we'll sell the idea and we'll cash out.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, I'm full of play. I'm full of great ideas. Just ask me. That's how I ended up in prison.
It's like the old George Carlin line. I have a lot of great ideas. The problem is they all suck.
Exactly.
Now, look, Damon, you seem to have managed to take your passion and parlay it into a career, you know. Scott and I both have like we have other jobs, you know. I'm a cybersecurity consultant. Scott does something, I'm not quite sure what, but some government related work in the public sector, you know. So, but at the end of my day, right, I sit in front of a computer all day. So at the end of that, when that's over, most times the last thing I want to do is then walk over to my personal computer and start doing other computer shit, you know, whether it's writing a screenplay or editing a video or whatever. I just had it, you know. So it is a challenge, I will tell you.
I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I love what I do, and I'm just comfortable being broke. That's all. That's the only difference between us. If I was smart, I would be out there working the job as well. I walk into the wall head first. Yeah. Go ahead.
But are you a plotter? Do you outline, or you just go by the seat of your pants?
That depends. So most short stories, just let's go. Start writing and it goes. But now, you know, longer form novels or whatever, that's impossible. You're going to hit the brick wall soon. So I've got a combination of the two that I like to utilize. Now, I like to get my first thing that I write, let's say the first chapter, the first intro scene, I like that to organically flow. I don't like to even know what I'm going to write. I'll just sit down and something comes out and I'm like, well, that's pretty neat. And once I know, like, okay, this is a story or this is going to be a story, I'll take that first scene, first couple scenes, and then I'll say, okay, what are the next 20 things that could happen? And I'll write down the next 20 things that could logically, chronologically happen, or things I would like to see happen. Then I'll narrow it down to maybe say, well, what's the best five out of those? And I'll take the best five out of them, put them in order, and then write those five scenes. And then I'll come back and revisit it again and say, well, what's 20 things that could happen? And then narrow it down and to the best five and put them in order. And then that pretty much tells me the direction of the story. Also keeping in mind, like, I know how it's going to end. I know some of the things that'll happen along the way. But that's the way it happened with that book I wrote that became so massive. I knew it was going to be an epic in the sense of It or The Stand, because that's the kind of story I wanted to write with a lot of different characters. So I had a lot of room to play. So then, you know, I sat down and I wrote the list of all these characters and who they were and what's their backstories. And I knew that I wanted to get to their backstories. And, you know, there was a lot to it. Now, with a short story, like something like a 5,000 word, which I'll have an idea, you know, probably think of, okay, what is this story about? Especially if I'm getting paid to do it, I'll try to put a little professionalism into it and think about what it's going to be and then just start writing it. And usually organically does me pretty well for the short stories.
Awesome.
What about you, Scott? I don't know if I've ever asked you that question.
I am definitely a seat of the pants type of a writer. To my detriment at times, because then it takes me a little bit longer to edit things. And I'll give you an example. Very recently, I wrote a scene with one particular character that I had specific plans for, but as I was writing this scene, she went and did something else, which totally fucked up what I was going to do with her later in the book. And so now I've got this problem of trying to incorporate what I did write into the rest of the book. I've got some ideas, but I think if I sat down and just plotted things out, I wouldn't have that issue nearly as much. But the reason that I do the fly by my seat of the pants routine is if I don't know what's going to happen, then chances are much greater that the reader isn't going to know what happened. And Todd, you know, I always appreciate, you know, the kind words you say. And I think you'll agree that with my books, you never know what's going to happen.
Oh, that's the understatement of the century. You know, well, you know, because they are, they especially Errors of the Flesh leans like right into my wheelhouse, which is like high fantasy, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, but with some real horror elements. And yeah, there were a couple of things in there where I was like, oh, okay, I know, kind of know where this is going. And then, whoa, what? You know, I'll be honest though, I do it, whether it's a movie or a book, just as a consumer of it, you know, as a lover of literature and movies, I enjoy a balance of some narrative predictability and then some, where did that come from? You know, otherwise, A, it's way too predictable and boring, or B, it's just a pile of random events that make no sense. You know what I mean? If that statement made any sense at all.
Well, no, it does. The predictability is always really good because it sets the reader at ease. It's something that they're comfortable with. They know, you know, they've experienced it before. But then you turn the screw and you do something that you don't expect, and it has more of an impact that way.
Yeah, I don't mind my expectations being subverted, you know, but then there are some times where it's really ham-handed, you know, and it seems like the writer, whether it's a screenwriter or whatever, just didn't quite know what to do now. So they said, oh, let's just throw something completely random. And I don't like, I hate that, you know, because then it's like, come on, you know, you literally pulled that out of your ass. So I find all this stuff fascinating. I'm always fascinated with the creative process, you know.
Who do you read, Damon?
I have read a lot of King. I've read a lot of Koontz. I'm a big fan of Ray Bradbury. I do read a lot of non-horror related stuff too, though. I loved Hemingway stuff. I love George Orwell, which I guess you could certainly put that in horror as well. But I read a lot of what's going on in the indie horror world too. So I read a lot of my peers and appreciate that as well. You know, there's the splatter guys like Daniel Volpe and Aaron Beauregard. Then other people who go a little less extreme, you know, James Carlson, Mick Collins, a little bit of everything. So lately, yeah, you know what, growing up, I grew up on King, but my favorite book of all time is Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
That's the one that did it for me right there.
I love the movie adaptation of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I have that on DVD. I think it was that Jason Robards. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great one. It, for me, there's no book or movie that captures the emotional sense of Halloween like that. That mystery, that feeling of mystery associated with autumn is surmised in Something Wicked This Way Comes. Yep. And it first hit me when I was a kid, and I've reread it many times since, and it's been like this stages of my life book that I keep going back to.
I remember seeing that movie as a kid and being absolutely terrified of Mr. Dark.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Just this totally menacing presence, you know, but yet was still like entrancing enough to pull you in. You know, I was absolutely terrified, and I'm pretty sure I did not want to go to any carnivals or fairs for about a year. Same way you mentioned Jaws, Damon. I was 7 when my genius father thought it was a good idea to take me to see Jaws while we were staying at my grandparents' shore house. Then couldn't figure out why I didn't want to go out on the boat, why I didn't want to go swimming. I'm like, we watched the same movie, right? Like, there's giant sharks out there, right? So, yeah, Mr. Dark, man, he's still scary.
Jonathan Pryce is so underrated in that role.
Agreed.
Mm. Yeah, no, he nailed it. So menacing, so creepy. And I love, you know, I mean, that whole, it appeals to the younger because it's a story of youth and youth wishing they were older. And then it appeals to me now because it makes you look back on the years and watch them as they pass, you know, very contemplative of, you know, where the time goes. So it speaks to me on both levels. It's really, really profound read.
Yeah, nobody captured childhood like Bradbury.
Mm. Yeah, so well done.
So, Damon, as I mentioned during the introduction, we met at, you know, a horror, you know, event, a sort of a vendor fair, and then I've seen you at other shows. Do you find so? I don't quite know how to phrase the question, but do you find that those shows do well for you as far as promoting yourself and your books?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you're going to get out of those shows whatever you put into them. If you're sitting there on your phone and waiting for people to come to you, you know, that's just not going to happen. You need to. I want to engage with everybody who walks past the table. I want to find out what they like to read, who their favorite authors are. And, you know, I want to learn something about everybody who walks by. So I try to, you know, I engage with everybody who comes by. And I've found these events to be the most beneficial for me building a fan base as far as my readership goes. You know, more followers on my social media, rather than just the, you know, put it out there on social media and hope that somebody buys my book or even advertising. These events where people get to come up and talk to you and interact. And I consider myself a storyteller. So if you come up to my table, I'm going to tell you a story, whether you want to hear it or not. I'm telling you a story. And I'll tell you a story about each and every one of those books. And I'm excited to do so because I love what I do. I love writing, and I love these stories because most of these stories I have lived in either before they were written or I lived through them as I was doing it. And I'm passionate about that. And I want to share that with everybody. And I had people come up to me. They're like, they didn't even want to buy a book. They're like, can I get a picture with you? I'm like, why would you want to? And they're like, you know, people were treating me like I was royalty or something. And it's so humbling and so endearing to, you know, get the feedback. And now I'm getting the feedback. I read your book. Oh my God, that was so good. I'm coming back to buy more. I was just at a show up in Sleepy Hollow, Paracon. So now I'm doing paranormal investigators, their conventions as well. Before I had even set up, one of the ladies who was there with her son who was vending comes over and buys 7 of my books in one shot. Before I'm even set up and the thing even starts, she goes over by her table, reads Abigail the 50 pages within like an hour or so, comes back and buys the rest of my books. And I'm like, that's so humbling and honoring. And, you know, I built up a fan base there. I made a connection, and I have a new friend who has been touched by something that I have an emotional connection to as well. So yeah, I for me, it's the events. I have 20 between now and the end of October.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately this weekend, both of my gigs are outside and it looks like it's going to rain, but Sunday I'm in Pompton Lakes, New Jersey, and William Shatner's going to be there. And I'm a fan. Let me tell you, I'm a fan. So like, although it might be raining and I'm outside and may not sell any books, I'm probably going to spend anything I might have made on getting a picture with William Shatner.
Yes. you gotta do it, man. You gotta do it. Yeah. Some years ago at a show, my daughter was with me and a friend of mine was the guy running the photo op thing. So he's like, look, you want a picture with Shatner? Just keep your mouth shut and I'll get you the hookup. I'm like, all right. He's like, just get in line and act like you belong there. So I said to my daughter, I want to say she was 12 or 13 at the time. I'm like, come on, Olivia, you want to be in the picture? I don't know. And I'm like, just trust your old man on this. Just trust me. So we go in, we take the picture with William Shatner. Now she shows all her friends that picture and they are all like, oh my God, you got your picture with Captain Kirk. And I said, I told you you would appreciate it someday. So, and he's what, 92 or 93?
Yeah. He's 92 years old.
Yeah. So just do it. Just get the picture with them.
Yeah. So I'm looking and, totally. And you know, it's $100 to get a picture with Shatner with your own phone, you know, which, yeah, you know, I mean, I think, oh, it's worth it. It's also $100 if you want an autograph without him, like even saying, Dear Damon, you know, just to write William Shatner on it. So, I mean, like, I think the picture over the autograph, you know. For me, I don't know that I'd go out and buy both. Although the autograph, I mean, you know, I could get William Shatner to autograph one of my books and then I'll sign it as well. And then I can auction it off on eBay. Signed by William Shatner and Damon Mann. I could maybe make $1,000.
Wow. There you go.
Like, well, I said, full of great ideas. They just all suck.
you know, it's funny, Scott and I have talked about it on the show. I rant about it on my socials all the time. I've been going to conventions for a really long time. And just watching the cost of these things go up and up and up. You know, I got so many big time autographs for free back in the day, or for maybe $10 or whatever. You're right. Now it's $100 to stand next to a person for 3 seconds so someone can take a picture on your phone. You know, at least when I got my picture with Shatner, it was a professional photo op where they printed out a nice glossy photo and gave it to you, you know, and I have it framed, you know, and everything. But look, yeah, man, everything is worth it to somebody, you know, so I never tell anyone how to spend their hard-earned money, you know. But yeah, of late, I am with you. For me, it's more about the encounter and the photo than a quick scribble of their name, you know, on a piece of paper.
Yeah. So you saw where I had my table for the last New Jersey HorrorCon film convention was set up. I was right next to the professional wrestlers. So I had a really good spot. I was right outside the green room. So, like everybody who walked by, I stopped them. Hey, Eric Roberts, would you like a free copy of Manxiety? Oh, sure. That's so nice. Could I get a picture of you holding it? I got a free picture taken with like the entire cast of Fright Night. I gave Amanda Beers, Marcy Darcy, a free copy of my book. She let me take a picture with her, and she gave me one of her autographs for free on her 8x10. I got a William Ragsdale, he stopped by, got a book, and allowed me to take a picture for free. Also, Jonathan Stark from Fright Night. So that was a really great positioning, being right outside the green room.
Did Dude, that it was. You're right. That was the best spot. And that was a good show. The Fright Night cast was all, they were all really cool. My daughter was beside herself because she met Chris Sarandon.
Yeah.
She loves The Nightmare Before Christmas. And he did, of course, the voice of Jack Skellington. And she's like, she's not one. She goes to cons with me. But she was never big on like, oh, let's get autographs. And she's like, Dad, the voice of Jack Skellington is here. Can we meet him? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I can arrange that. I'm like, let's go. And she was just beside herself. So
that's very cool.
It was very cool. But I just want to touch very quickly on something you said, Damon, because I said it before. The whole reason we're even having this conversation is because you are not one of those people who just sits behind their table acting disinterested, you know? I have bought so many books or CDs or something, comic books or whatever, from people just because they were friendly and engaging. And I wish more people understood that. You know, you're at a convention. There's tons of other authors there. There's tons of artists. Like, there's a million people where I could spend my money. Why would I approach someone who just looks like they don't even want to be there? You know, oh, I'm going to set up a table, put out a bunch of stuff, and hope that people look at it and want to buy it. Well, why? There's a lot of authors out there. Let's be honest. You know, so you got to do something to get me, to get my attention. You know, that's just how it is.
Yeah, definitely. I agree 100% with that. And it's, you know, I have a tendency to talk too much, probably rather than the other way. So, you know, and I'm interested. I like to meet new people, and I'm always interested in making that connection. And I think that's what it's all about. You know, you could buy anybody's book, but you know, when you've met the author and then you get to know him a little bit, I think it makes the reading the book a little bit more, you know?
Oh, I absolutely agree. Like, I'm like, oh, I met that guy, you know, I met that person. So I agree. Cause at the end of the day, I'm just a fan, you know, when I was at that flea market where I first met you, I was there, I wasn't doing interviews or anything like I usually do. I was just, it's a fanboy day, you know? So I'm like, oh, I'm going to go pick up some merch, see what's out there, you know? So I'm speaking just as a fan. So you're 100% right.
Yeah, and I'm a fan myself, you know, of the genre, of the films, of the books, all of that, the clothing. So I go there and I buy stuff first. I got this awesome shirt with and on the back of this, it's black shirt, is the scene from The Thing, you know, with the person standing there with the light coming out of their head.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I got this really cool shirt from that. But, yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, my first con was just over a year ago. I just started doing cons or flea markets a little over a year ago. And I'm trying to fill my schedule with them because, you know, that's the way to go. And it's, here in New Jersey, we have everything. Like, there, you don't have to go all that far ever to go to a convention or, you know, we've got New York, we've got Connecticut, we've got Pennsylvania, and everything in New Jersey. I'm doing 20 in the next 2 months with leaving the state once. So there's so much here, and to actually meet with fellow horror fanatics in my own area, I mean, that's where you develop friendships, and that's where you develop people who readerships. You do a grassroots movement, and I feel that's the way I will rise to where I want to be one day as an author.
Well, there you go. And as we're approaching the end of our time, that is a good segue into some additional shameless self-promotion for both of us, because speaking of events, you will be appearing at my upcoming event, October 18th and 19th, the Grindhouse Nights Film Festival at Crossroads in Garwood, New Jersey. So we're very excited to have you there. It should be a fun event.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Anything to happen right around this time of year and actually throw in film festival and music and put it in a restaurant? Hey, I'm all about that. hang out with you again. That's a win-win in my book.
Well, it is a fun event, and the venue has made some changes. So the area, you know, we're not a vendor driven event, but we like to have some variety of things for people to do at the event. So it'll be you and a couple other people, and the area now, it used to be that the vendors and artists and stuff would kind of be segregated, if you will, and I really didn't like that. But in the way the new space is set up, all the films that will be screening inside the main venue will also be screening on a separate screen in the room where the vendors are, and which is sort of like the overflow area for capacity. So you won't feel like, oh, where the vendors or the authors are separated. You know, you'll be able to watch all the films and be hanging out with the fans and the attendees and stuff. So it should be a good time.
Sounds great.
Hopefully you sell some books as well.
Yeah.
Authors tend to do very well at my event. Like merchandise vendors, really not so much, again, because it really is a film festival, but it's a horror film festival. So we historically, when we've had a horror author, they've done very well. So be a fun time.
Looking forward to it for sure. That's definitely on my excitement list for this nice. Coming next month. Yeah.
So all what right. else do you have going on, Todd?
Well, really right now, all my time is consumed with us getting ready for the film festival. We are prepping. I should be releasing the screening schedule today or tomorrow, followed by our list of award nominees. Every year it gets harder and harder because, Scott, you were a judge. So
yeah,
there was a lot of quality stuff this year. So it's been really hard to judge the films, but I think we have a good list and some cool nominees. And we have a lot of local filmmakers that will be in attendance. So I'm really psyched about that. So
that's always cool when you have the filmmakers there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So that's the biggest thing on my mind right now is Grindhouse Nights Film Festival, October 18th and 19th at Crossroads in Garwood, New Jersey. And yes, folks, it's a Wednesday and a Thursday. For those of you that don't own a physical calendar or don't have a calendar on your phone, like to look it up. The 18th and 19th is a Wednesday and a Thursday. So I just want to make that abundantly clear. What about you, Scott? And then Damon, I assure you, you'll close us out with giving us everyone all your information on where they can find you.
Well, you can get my books at Amazon. You can get the paperbacks there. You can get the eBooks wherever eBooks are sold. And, of course, you've got the audio books at audible.com. And I have great readers for my books. I lucked out so much with the readers that I got for the novels. And, you know, I know, Todd, you talk about how good
100%. They are. You really hit the lottery with all of the narrators for your books. Yeah. That's for sure.
I just got so fucking lucky with those. So you can pick those up at Audible, and the Tree of Everlasting Sorrow is coming along well. And Todd, I don't know if I ever told you or if I've ever mentioned it on the show, but you know, this is another Western, kind of like Barbed Wire Kisses, and it's set in a carnival.
Shut up.
With a lot of clowns, including one who continuously.
Fuck right off with the clown. Well, at least it's not ventriloquist dummies.
Not yet.
Okay.
So
good stuff.
I just got to the 41,000 word mark with that, and I'll be finished with that definitely by the end of October, beginning of November. So it'll be out early next year. And I'm looking forward to the reaction to that because, again, it's a Western, but it's still a little bit different than what Barbara Kisses is and certainly from what anything else I've written is.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Damon, the floor is yours.
So let's see. So I have a lot of shows going on, so I guess I really can't be too specific about all of those. This coming weekend, though, you know, doing that Pompton Lakes show at 19 Perrin Ave on Sunday. Special guest William Shatner will be there. Anybody who would like to check out anything that I might have written, there's a couple ways you can do that. Do so. You can always go to my Amazon page and take a look at Damon Manx. That's spelled D-A-E-M-O-N-M-A-N-X. I also have two websites where you can read about any of my books, or also buy them directly and get signed copies. So you could go to www.damonmanx.com to check out my own site. You can also check out my publishing house, which is Last Waltz Publishing. That's www.lastwaltzpublishing.com. Not only do I sell all of my own books there, I have several authors who work under the publishing house available as well. We've just recently put out a young adult zombie book for the young horror readers in the family. So if you want to raise them right, we've got something that's young adult friendly for the new readers. It's called Nightmare on Indigo Street. Other than that, I'm going to be at Monster Mania this year in November in Oaks, PA. I'm going to be at Wreck the Hall's Trenton Punk Rock Festival down in Trenton, New Jersey. And I'm going to be back at the Horror Sideshow in December in Edison, New Jersey. There's a lot of other events between now and then. And you just go to the events page on my website and you can see them all.
Fantastic. Damon, it was awesome having you on the show. We don't give this out to too many people, but whenever, you know, you want to come back on, you've got something new to announce or whatever, you want to come on and chat, just let me know.
That'd be great. We'll
definitely have you back.
Thank you so much.
I would definitely want to have you back on after your dramatization comes out next month. I would love to talk about that and hear more about it.
Yeah, and I can bring a couple audio clips of that to, you know, share with everybody to see what it's all about. That would be awesome. It's really gripping, and when this one is one of those where, you know, the violence and the gore go a little bit above and beyond the necessary threshold. And in the audio version, it's, yeah, you're not, you don't want to be eating while you're listening to this.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
That sounds perfect for you on one of your drives down to Virginia, Todd.
Yeah, not anymore.
Maryland now. Maryland, right?
Not anymore. No. She's in Pennsylvania now, but it's still an hour and 20, so I do have time. Again, Damon, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad we met. And became friends, and I look forward to having you at my event.
I'm looking forward to it myself, and thank you both so much for having me.
Thank you for being on, Damon. I really do appreciate it. I always love having other writers on.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, and until next time, may all of your journeys be filled with pure imagination.